The theme for these talks has been the four right efforts. Making the effort. And the Buddha was, when he described this, he used like many synonyms for this. Making the effort, striving, endeavoring, persevering. He was really into this idea of you really make effort, a certain kind of effort. And make effort to prevent the arising of unskillful states that have not yet arisen. Making effort to abandon those unskillful states that have arisen. Make effort to cultivate those skillful states that have not yet arisen. Make effort to maintain those skillful states that have arisen. And it seems kind of complicated, all this, and like kind of exhausting maybe to effort. But in fact, as I said maybe at the beginning of the retreat, we do this kind of effort all the time, we just don't think about it that way. And even just how you've chosen to sit, listening to this talk, if some consideration went into avoiding really uncomfortable positions that have not yet arisen. And then when the discomfort does arise, some of you will abandon that and shift your posture. And then cultivate a good way of sitting. You know, where you're alert, present, comfortable, relaxed. You can kind of be receptive to the Dharma talk. And then if you have that kind of good quality in your sitting, keep it going. Maintain it. So you're already doing these things. And so it's not such a foreign thing, these four efforts. But they are a way of understanding almost anything we do, and including how we do our Dharma practice. And the... You know, in the language of this of the Buddha, he used skillful and unskillful. And one of my favorite things from later in Theravadan Buddhism, my favorite part of what's called the Abhidhamma, the later kind of Buddhist psychology. And at some point, they switched, and they still talked about unskillful states that you can be in, but instead of calling using the expression skillful for the opposite, they use the term beautiful. Beautiful states. So that's quite nice. And these are beautiful states that are your potential. And I think of it as a very positive way of looking at potential for every human being, that within them is the possibility of tremendous beauty. And the hope is that on retreats like this, that you either experience or you have some intimation of a possibility of experiencing something which is quite valuable within you. For all the emphasis in Buddhism on letting go and equanimity, it seems like you're not supposed to have any preferences. And for a long time, Vipassana teachers would quote Tao Te Ching, something like, or there was a Zen, I think that they, Zen teaching, not Tao Te Ching, a Zen teaching, the way is easy for those who have no preferences. And there's something very profound about that statement. However, there's nothing wrong with having preferences. In fact, at least in the teachings of the Buddha, you're supposed to have preferences. The whole four right efforts involves having preferences. That you prefer not to have unskillful states, so that's why you let go of them, and you prefer to have beautiful ones. And so certainly letting go is an important part of practice, and certainly equanimity is important, but that doesn't mean that we don't value and prefer and cultivate and maintain beautiful qualities, beautiful things, valuable ways of which we can be. we're not supposed to be completely neutral about how we are, because we are wonderful people. We have wonderful capacities and abilities. The whole Dharma is not to make a whole bunch of neutral people who walk around neutral. I think the Dharma is about bringing forth your freedom, bringing forth your radiance, your beauty, bringing forth that which is good, really good and wholesome within us, and let that flow through us in a free way, not in a way that does involve clinging, not in a way that does interfere with our equanimity, not in a way that we get kind of one-sided by only focusing on the good, but by getting out of the way so that the skillful, the beautiful, the valuable has a chance to flow freely. It is possible to get out of the way and allow the unskillful to flow, because that's also a potential within us. And the art of all this is to know how to make room for that which is skillful or beautiful or our freedom. So part of the value of a retreat, maybe not this retreat, but or meditation, maybe not this session of meditation, but hopefully at some point for people, is to touch into some way of being, some quality of mind, heart, some state of something, well-being, that is preferable to other states. It's preferable to be loving than to be hateful. It's preferable to be generous than it is to be greedy. It's preferable to be calm than it is to be stressed out. It's preferable to be open-minded to being narrow-minded or closed-minded. There are preferences that we have, because it isn't preferences that need to involve a lot of reflection, but it's as obvious as if I have a thorn in my foot, it's preferable to take it out. It doesn't require a lot of thinking, and equanimity does not mean that you just keep it in and keep walking and you're supposed to be, everything's supposed to be equal and, you know, and you're supposed to just let go, it hurts, but you just let go and take another, you know, and then say, you know, just take the next step into the next moment, you know, just be wholeheartedly, be open and yes, and just step into the next moment with that with that thorn, you know. I think I'm getting it now. Take out the thorn. And so we carry these thorns inside of ourselves. And we do things that hurt, ouch. And sometimes we don't realize how much they hurt until we develop the kind of sensitivity and awareness that this kind of deep mindfulness can bring forth. And for some people, the first lesson of practice is to say, ouch. Wow, I didn't realize how much it hurt. And layers and layers of that realization. For me, one layer was when I was practicing in Burma, and I was doing a long retreat there, and I was doing walking meditation. And by this time, I had actually a lot of joy in my practice, a strong sense of well-being and peace and joy. And mind was fairly quiet. I was doing walking meditation, and I watched my mind start thinking, being involved in thought. It probably was relatively benign thoughts. However, I could see that in even the benign thought as it came, there was a very, very subtle tension, or very subtle little ouch involved in having that thought. And I thought, well, you know, here I am sitting, you know, I'm in so much peace and joy. If that has a certain kind of ouch in it, there is a lot of suffering in this world out there. Because if this is what everyone's mind is doing when they're thinking, I mean, there's obvious suffering, huge suffering we can see. But if everyone is carrying along this kind of subtle layer of thinking all the time, that's a lot. I was kind of stunned. I think I stopped in my tracks. I was blown away by the magnitude of suffering in this world. But what was interesting was, that was interesting enough in itself, but what was also interesting was that magnitude, I wasn't overwhelmed or I wasn't crushed by it or didn't, because it was received into this field here of well-being and peace. I had the space for it, to hold it and be with it. If I hadn't had the space, if it was really tight and narrow, or full of, you know, very closely connected to, you know, my issues of self-preservation and my own feeling or something, that realization could have just maybe, you know, been something very difficult to hold. So we have these ouches, and it's preferable to take out the thorn. And as we get more sensitive in practice, we start noticing more and more some of the thorns. And there's a whole series of ways in which this kind of practice we do is a series of bad news. Because we start seeing, you know, the first relatively coarse level of activity in the mind, we start seeing more and more subtle how it works. But it's really good news, because it's really important to see it and understand it, and not to push it away, not to pretend it's not there, not to somehow react to it. This is where the equanimity is really important, is a willingness to see. And not a few Dharma students I know have taken these teachings of the Buddhism and felt that somehow they had to just kind of be so detached that they weren't really interested or willing to look at the ouches, look at how their mind was actually functioning. But to really grow and develop and mature and to really kind of be wise about the human condition, to really understand it well in this world of ours, we have to really understand our human condition, all its aspects. And so, even though sometimes it's bad news what we see, painful news, the hope is that through practice, is through understanding the Dharma, that you welcome it. They say, oh, and actually in some ways, rather than being discouraged by it, you feel encouraged because now you found the path. This is where your practice is. Great. I didn't know I had an anger problem. But this is great. And now that's the Dharma door for me. That's where I have to practice. I'm so lucky. And the people who are neutral, there's very little Dharma. Very little Dharma doors, probably in complete neutral. So we learn to see these things, but then at some point, we also see the other side, the good news. And we start seeing that there are preferable ways of being. There are states of mind and qualities of heart and actions we can take that are meaningful, that are valuable, that are preferable, that are important. And then some of those have become the North Star for us. Oh, that shows us the way forward. Oh, yeah. Being generous. That's a good thing. Having a sense of generosity. And so, you know, you don't want to try too hard to be generous, but that's a North Star to try to become generous. Try to let that be a natural part of you, or let that kind of grow. Or when you have inklings of generosity, that you've recognized this is an important part of you, and rather than letting it be an inkling in the background, you kind of say yes to it, you're open to it. And, or you have a sense of, what ethical purity is like. You know, when you're You feel like there's this ethical goodness inside of you. It's a beautiful quality. What sometimes comes with, for me, it came first with retreat practice. A sense of kind of the language I had, which was a word that I found, I don't know if repulsive is too strong of a word, but a word that I, by policy, did not want to have anything to do with. And that was the word purity. I was kind of like, you know, purity and saccharine went together. And so I wasn't interested in purity and Hallmark cards. So it became quite a surprise to me, and sitting doing this same practice you've been doing here, that this tremendous sense of being really clean inside, cleanliness or purity arose, that I recognize as kind of ethical purity. And, you know, it wasn't so much that, you know, even with that, it wasn't so much like I then wanted to be moral, but rather this was valuable. This was beautiful. This was something not only to cherish and touch into, because it's the opposite of an ouch. It feels so good. But also, it became a North Star or something to realize, oh, other people have this potential too. This resides in other people as well. And it began a process by allowed me to appreciate other people much more in a deeper way. Even if they didn't have ethical purity, I kind of could feel or know that that's in there too. And so that was beginning. And so as I kept practicing, I started to discover all these different things inside of me. I was really surprised to discover loving kindness. I did not like loving kindness. And when my teachers, Vipassana teachers, started doing loving kindness meditation, I tuned them out. You know, I was well trained as a Zen student, and back then, you know, that this was just kind of artificial to do loving kindness. You know, you're supposed to just be, you know, go right for the emptiness. Which sometimes, if you go right for the emptiness, you end up neutral. But then it kind of, this loving kindness thing kind of just, I didn't want it. But again, I was just doing my practice, and it welled up. You know, so sometimes I'm a slow learner sometimes, so sometimes it has to come from the inside in its own time. And so, beautiful thing, beautiful quality. Compassion, the same way, welled up with practice for me. And then there's things like joy that can well up, gladness. So they're one of those wonderful, we have so many wonderful questions this retreat. I wish we took time with all of them, but here's one that came. I've come to notice that while engaging in walking practice, a feeling of delight arises. Noticing my feet, feeling the bottom of my feet on the floor, feeling the movement of my weight from one hip to another, moving, the feeling of motion. As what feels like gladness arises, being with these feelings is so innocent and simple. Then, tears. I look for thoughts, but seem to find none. It feels like release, but I know there must be a thought. Best to go back to breath, or stay with emotion. Notice that delight equals tears, or can you speak a bit more about the depth of walking practice? Well, the person just wrote about the depth of walking practice. I'll go study with that person. So this delight, the gladness arises. Just, you know, it's amazing, you know, that just being fully in the present with one thing, there's something about surrendering or opening or yesing to just this moment that, not automatic, it's not initially, but with time, with doing it, creating the conditions for it, at some point, the present moment, the presence that we have is a kind of presence of joy, of delight, of gladness, appreciation, the simplicity of it. And it's a remarkable thing to discover a sense of well-being inside that doesn't require, you know, winning the lottery or getting the right date or money in your bank account or anything in the world. It just kind of wells up just from how we are here now, present. And tears is not uncommon. You know, because so touching, it can be so moving for some people that the tears come. And it feels like release. I look for thoughts, but seem to find none. It feels like release. I guess meaning that release is the closest word, thought, to couldn't describe it. Release, freedom. And this is one of the things that, you know, qualities or beautiful things inside is release or freedom or openness, non-clinging. And it's an interesting thing, non-clinging, release. You know, if I make a fist, like I, you know, grasp really well, cling really well, there's not a lot of things you can do with a fist, but, you know, if I go around like this in front of you, you probably wonder. There's not a lot of things that communicates. Good fist. But if I release the grasping, free the fist, free the hand, I have an open hand. And that is a lot more you can do with an open hand than a fist. I mean, if I came to you like this, or like this, or like this, or like this, or I stroked you, you know, with open hand, it's very different communication. And I'm much more open and available to all kinds of things with an open hand. So, the logical thing to do, because it's so special, so much can be done with an open hand, it feels so good, the logical thing to do is to cling to it. I got it. I have it. It's mine. You don't have it anymore. It's disappeared. It's gone. It doesn't exist. So you can't cling to a lot of these beautiful states. You can't cling to freedom and openness, because in the very clinging, it disappears. So this is partly why in these right efforts, you can't try too hard. And as I said in my previous talk, a lot of what we're trying to do in practice is not to make things happen, but to create the conditions so that they can arise. And so putting together the right conditions. And so, you know, and that involves not just how the conditions you put together on a retreat, but also the conditions that you put together on, you know, in your whole life, how you live your life. And one of the characteristics of people who really take the potential of Dharma practice fully to heart is that they want to orient their whole life around it and really organize their life in such a way their whole life has the conditions that allow for the flowering, to develop the growth of all these beautiful qualities. So things like then ethics becomes very important, sila, how we speak, how we relate to other people, how we relate to our planet, how we relate to ourselves. And some of that, you know, you have choice about what you do. You know, if you're killing people, stop. If you're stealing, stop. If you're involved in sexual misconduct, stop. If you're involved in lying, you know, that stop. It gets more difficult, I think, as we get down through the more. If you're doing intoxication, stop. To some degree, we have choice about these behavioral things that we do. The desires, the cravings for these things, the impulse for it might still be there. But it can be a heroic thing for some people to stop and not do these anymore. And those will create very different conditions. When you stop doing those, they create different conditions than if you do them. And so we want to create the conditions. And then there's the conditions of living ethically by being kind, You don't have to always feel kind to be kind. And it's not necessarily insincere to be friendly, or insincere to be caring for others if you don't really kind of feel all that way. You can want to do it even if you don't feel like it. Isn't that interesting? Or you can want to do it because you know that it's going to put together the right conditions that's, you know, over time will flower in something. And so, you know, you don't want to force something or pretend too much, but there is something to be said about stepping forward into the world in a friendly way or a kind way or caring way and making that effort, especially if you're shy or inhibited or that's not your tendency. Chances are you can find some inkling of wanting to do that in you and then step forward and say yes to that in the way that's appropriate for you. And then there's things practicing generosity, considered to be a very important condition for the cultivation of the path. There's something about what the heart, the mind goes through when it releases something and offers something to someone else that is partly kind of freeing something in ourselves, but also creating a wonderful relationship, hopefully, with other people, creating the right kind of connection, that the kind of friendly connection that supports, that creates also conditions for the path to arise. And then there's meditating, you know, practicing mindfulness and meditation. You know, putting yourself on the cushion every day. You might not be feel like every meditation is successful or good or all that, but to do it every day, something begins to shift and change, sometimes imperceptibly. Even if it just means you're connecting to the Dharma again or connecting to that intention you have to practice, over time it can be revolutionary. The two analogies for this that I like, one is two parallel lines that go on forever stay equidistance. But if you nudge it, one of the lines slightly off to the side, and one way away from the other one, it might be imperceptibly at first. Eventually, the distance between them becomes immense. So if you make a little change, and I would suggest like sitting every day, you might not see the change initially, but over time it can be a huge change. The other analogy I like of this is that I was told about a yoga teacher who, back when they had telephone books, there's a pose called a triangle pose, where one you're supposed to keep your legs kind of straight, kind of like a triangle shape, and then bring your hand down on the floor. And if you can't reach your hand to the floor, then you're supposed to get telephone books and build them up until you can be supported in a good yoga posture. And then do it every day, and every day tear out one telephone page. And you know, remember those pages were really thin? Right? And so it's like imperceptible each time, but eventually you'll go to get down to the bottom. So there's regularity of practice, regularity of the intention, regularity of follow through, just showing up, and being willing to show up when it's difficult, being willing to show up when it's easy. Some people meditate only when they're feeling lousy. Some people only meditate when they feel good. Ideally, you do both, so you can process your whole life in it. Coming on retreats is a condition. Studying the Dharma, hearing the Dharma. Remember, in my other talk, I talked about one of the conditions associating with good people, and hearing the Dharma is a support for all this. But one of the things that happens when people practice, like on retreat especially, can happen in other ways as well, is at some point, something gets awoken inside of us. At some point, there's a recognition of something that's valuable. There's a recognition that there's something beautiful here. And it's preferable. And it's worth maintaining. Don't let go too easily. Let go of your clinging, but don't let go of maintaining. Keep it going. Don't keep it going by clinging to it or expecting it to stay or demanding it stay, but try to stay close to it. Try to nourish it. Try to support it. Try to let it kind of grow inside of you. If you feel joy, stay close to it. You get up from meditation maybe, or some other reason, you go for a nice hike in the park or something, and you feel really relaxed and joyful. You come home, and it might be really important to see how what's the latest and the greatest in the presidential campaign. And because it makes you more joyful, that, that supports your joy, it nourishes it, it helps you maintain it, by all means. So once the joy is there, once some kind of some sense of well-being is there, some feeling of relaxation, do you know what you do? Do you safeguard it? Do you somehow maintain it? Or are you all too easy to let go of it, forget its importance? And it's one thing to, you know, check the news or something like that. How often do you sacrifice your well-being, your peace, your joy, your contentment, your love, your something? Because there's really good things to worry about. Really worthwhile. You know. Other people worry about, you know, unimportant things, but you have like first class worries. And so, what is that? What kind of equation? What kind of real reflection? Real kind of consideration has gone into your choice, about what you pick up in your mind. Is it worth sacrificing your well-being, your joy, your peace, your calm, for a particular worry? I used to spend a lot of time planning the future, and some of you have heard me. I said this many times, but I very slowly came to realize that how pointless it was, and I slowly by realizing what a tremendously poor success rate I had in predicting the future. I would plan, and I'd show up, and it was all so different than anything I could have imagined. Or I planned for something and it was canceled. Or I planned for something and, I don't know, it was just different. And so, you know, there is a sign of wisdom when after 10,000 times that it dawned on me, you know, I have a very poor prediction rate. Maybe I'm better off not planning so much and coming more fresh and just kind of seeing what happens there. And for me, part of those plans came along with worry. I was anxious about what I was going to do. And I could see how when I got involved in those plans and anxiety, that I lost something. And I think initially I didn't value joy. I didn't value peace. I'd never been told that it was important or valuable. I never had any sense that it was in my control. Either it's coming or it's going. I hadn't got the teachings about the conditions that support things. And I hadn't never been told that you should maintain it. I only knew that there were some people I met who had these very artificial smiles and were very buoyantly optimistic that made me sick. I didn't want to be that way. So I didn't learn that lesson, that it was okay to maintain, to try to keep it going. One way to maintain it is to practice the first two right efforts that Inez talked about. When unskillful states arise, let go of those so the good states can have a chance to keep staying. And if you know there are things you're going to do that bring up the unskillful states, if it's not necessary to do those things, maybe don't do them. So if you leave the retreat tomorrow and maybe you're in a relatively good mood, maybe you're a little bit more relaxed than you came, but you just have to find out what happened in the primaries. Or just have to find out how many emails you got. Quickly. Because, you know, people are waiting for responses. And it's crucial that you respond to every email, otherwise you're going to hurt all these people. And so you sacrifice, you give up your calm. So you don't have to. Take your good states seriously. Maintain them, not by forcing them to be there, not to do it artificially, but maintain them for a while at least by being very careful that you don't succumb to the opposite, that you don't destroy them or leave them behind because you're off to better worries. Relax. Stay close. The Dharma, principle of the Dharma, is that you are really important. You are really valuable. That you have the capacity for tremendous nobility and dignity. Buddhist practice is not about becoming self-effacing and becoming a nobody. Somehow being a ghost, you know, like you're so empty, no self. You know, and people can just kind of put their hand through you and there's no one there. I mean, this guy who's sitting up here on the stage, right? I mean, look at that statue. Look at that dignity and the strength and the confidence that statue kind of represents to the Buddha sitting there. This is someone who realized this thing about not self. But look at that. I mean, and conventionally we'd say, wow, that person's really there in a self-confident, self-reassured, powerful way, dignified way. So there's a tremendous valuing of you in this process. How you are and what's there is beautiful. It's something wonderful. And that it's worth safeguarding. It's worth caring for it. It's worth tending it. It's worth putting together the conditions that allows the best in you to flower and grow. It's worth maintaining it. And I like this word maintain because I think it has maybe at least two meanings that comes to mind. One is it means just to keep it going, but the other, you know, you maintain something by keeping it, servicing it, keep servicing it. So we keep servicing ourselves. So finally, one of the ways to maintain the skillful states, skillful qualities, is to allow yourself to be nourished by them. This idea of being nourished, being fed, take the time to let them really register in the marrow of your bones. Take your time to really receive the goodness that comes from what's good inside of you. Take the time to appreciate it. So many of us are somehow self-effacing. So many of us so quickly to kind of diminish ourselves as like we don't count and how I am doesn't count. Or I can't be joyful around because people in the world are suffering, or I don't deserve it, or all kinds of reasons why we kind of don't really, you know, sometimes reluctant to feel all this. Sometimes we're apologetic, you know, it's not okay to be happy. something like that, but to be nourished by it. Take the time. Recognize what's good in you. Recognize what's good here now. Chances are there's a lot more good happening, a lot more healthy, skillful things happening at any given moment than you've allowed yourself to tune into. Be nourished by it. Take it in. Be nourished by the trees around you. Be nourished by the breeze and the wind. I received two email messages, some people wrote me this week, and both of them had been nourished by water. One person who had a tremendous amount of personal challenges would sit by the ocean, and the waves would just wash through her and wash her tears away. She felt cleansed by it. She did it for a long time. It really made a big difference. She was nourished by that. Someone else found that taking a bath was tremendously freeing for her when she was on retreat. And she had so much pain and so much stiffness, so much holding, so much pushing and pushing and trying. And then she snuck in to and took an illicit bath. And she relaxed. And then she was being nourished by that, being fed by that, gave her, pointed her how to continue on her retreat, supported her. Be nourished. Allow yourself to be, that's why this yes and opening up, so you can be receptive, you can register, it can inform you, it can have an influence on you. Let it have an influence on you. Let it travel through you. Be open. Allow it to have an influence on you. If you always think you know what's supposed to happen, you can't allow something new to happen. If you're always kind of the one directing the show, you're not really allowing the conditions to feed you, to arise in you. And in the end, I suspect that each of you will discover what I've discovered. Many things to discover, but right now to mention that the Dharma knows better than you do what's supposed to happen. If you open, if you are really present here and now for this moment, this experience, let yourself be nourished by the good that's here. Allow yourself to be honest about what's difficult here. Step forward and say yes and really be here. That what arises and what comes through you, you probably could never have planned or expected. But the Dharma knows better than you what is supposed to happen to you. And this idea that you know what's supposed to happen, I think is a delusion. Every retreat is different. Some people leave the retreat and come to retreat with expectations, what's supposed to happen. Some people leave, occasionally people leave disappointed. What I hoped, what happened didn't happen. But I believe that you always get just the right thing. It's always the right retreat. The Dharma knows what you need to face, be with. So, prevent the arising of unarisen, unskillful states, which means don't let unskillful states occur. If unskillful states arise, let them go. They're the obstacles to letting the water flow down the hill. make effort to bring forth, cultivate, sprout skillful states, beautiful states. And once the skillful states have arisen, maintain them, nurture them, be nourished by them. It's a beautiful thing. So I want to thank you for engaging in this process these days. And there's still more practice to be done on this retreat that's not over. And we'll gather in here at 7:30. So let's sit for a minute or so and get recollected.